Have we been here before? Seems so familiar somehow. The thought arose this morning. If we're resisting anything, we're resisting Buddha nature. That's today's Zazen instruction. And upon looking into this thought, more and more I felt, yes, that's really a complete Zazen instruction. And it's okay, we can resist things and therefore resist Buddha nature. But anything that we're resisting is Buddha nature. Yes.
And is our resistance not Buddha nature?
We could say that. Our resistance is also Buddha nature. So therefore, if we resist our resistance, we're resisting Buddha nature. Or another way to say it is, if we resist our resistance, Buddha nature is resisting Buddha nature. Which, again, just like resistance is okay, that's okay too, for Buddha nature to resist Buddha nature. It's all okay. But if we kind of look at the other side of this, we'd say, if we're according with anything, any one thing, being in accord with or harmonizing with one thing, we're harmonizing with Buddha nature. We're in accord with Buddha nature. And is according or harmonizing Buddha nature? Yes. So Buddha nature's according with Buddha nature. So the question could be asked, is Buddha nature resisting Buddha nature the same or different from Buddha nature according with Buddha nature? Because everything that's coming to us every moment is Buddha nature. But often when we're resisting it, we're not often, I think, acknowledging that it's Buddha nature. That's why I feel like it could be a helpful Zazen instruction to see the very thing that we're resisting is Buddha nature. So then is there a way to accord with it? For example, physical pain on the fourth day of Sesshin, we might resist that Buddha nature. The Buddha nature that's manifesting through a fiery knee. But to accord with that fiery knee, we don't know what that will look different for each of us, how we respond to that, how to take care of the Buddha nature of the fiery knee. It may mean moving right away. It may mean just observing it for a little bit. It may mean moving and then just being with that having moved without it setting into a chain reaction of moving because of the moving, because of the moving, for example. Yes.
This is just resonating, having been working with it several days.
Resistance?
Or struggling. But my experience has, the word that occurred to me was with the according, was intimacy.
Yeah.
And with resisting, just like moving, resisting, and I've been experiencing that if I'm resisting, then just allowing it to be like that kind of falls away.
Yeah, according with the resisting. Yeah.
And then there's more intimacy.
Yeah. And you know, these we could spend a while defining exactly what we mean by these terms, but just, you know, basically it seems that that energy of resistance, if we're really intimate with it, and we could call that according with it, being you know, in harmony with this Buddha nature that's manifesting as resistance, then we could even say that it's no longer resistance in the way that it was. It now seems like something else. Yeah. So, yes. Yes.
I like that instruction. After 1970, I spent many, many years resisting and engaging in karmic activity, which evolved consequences I would not have chosen. However, here I am. And what I found out, especially since deepening practice in the last, you know, so years, is all the worst things that ever happened to me are the best things that ever happened to me.
Yeah, so that's another way to learn that by according with resistance, it changes into something else, or the worst things are seen in a new light. I think this can often happen, especially in Sesshin. It can shift. I think I mentioned the other day that shift of like the big, huge weight of like the biggest problem ever about to crush us. And then the slightest shift of perspective, the mind becomes more and more malleable and flexible as we sit. And then where is that huge boulder? Now it's underneath us, maybe, pushing us up from below. So, back to Dogen. And let me just present some for a while, and then we can have more questions at the end. Dogen now brings up another story. Chan Master Da Chir of Mount Baijiang, our great Chinese ancestor Baijiang, addressed the assembly. Buddha is the highest vehicle, the highest of all wisdoms, the person who maintains the Buddha way. It is Buddha being Buddha nature. It is a guiding teacher. It is being able to utilize a way that is utterly unhindered or unobstructed. Unresisted. It is unimpeded wisdom. In all this, it readily utilizes cause and effect. It is the free activity of, this translation says, seeking enlightenment and enlightening others, which is a quite liberal translation of merit and wisdom. I'll come back to this point. It is the vehicle that carries on cause and effect. This is Bhajan continuing. Negotiating life, it's not held back by life. Negotiating death, it's not hindered by death. We're talking about Buddha nature. Negotiating the five skandhas, it's like a gate freely opening. It suffers no restriction by the five skandhas. It goes and stops at will, leaves and enters unhindered. Inasmuch as it is thus, distinctions between high and low, intelligent and ignorant, are immaterial. And since this is the same, even down to the body of the tiniest ant, all is a wondrous land of purity beyond our comprehension. Bhajan's wonderful celebration of Buddha nature, pervading all activity, making no distinctions, not being hindered by life or death, negotiating the five aggregates of body and mind. Buddha nature's having some negotiations with our body and mind. So this point about it readily utilizes cause and effect. It's the free activity of merit and wisdom. This translator said, it's the free activity of seeking enlightenment and enlightening others, which we could say is wisdom and merit, his interpretation. But the Chinese says it's the free activity of merit and wisdom, Buddha nature is. And I just thought I could use this opportunity to mention a bit about merit and wisdom. Someone yesterday said to me, they felt like it might be a weakness of Soto Zen and Dogen Zen that it emphasizes non-duality so much that there's like nothing, doesn't give you much like to work with, to practice with. Sometimes it's true, it may seem that way. And another person said to me yesterday something like, oh, sometimes these teachings of non-duality and mind only can seem kind of cold, and there's not much, sometimes it's hard to find the heart in them. So Bhajan, the non-dual Zen teacher, says that Buddha nature is the free activity of both merit and wisdom. So this is referring to this little talk to about this classic Mahayana teaching, that the conditions for realizing Buddhahood, now we say Buddhahood is unconditioned, but for the time being we could speak of conditions for realizing this unconditioned Buddhahood. And if we say there's basically just two, the simplest list, it's just, there's only two conditions that have to be fulfilled for Buddhahood in the classic Mahayana model. The complete accumulation of merit and complete accumulation of wisdom. That's all we need. And so merit is punya, And wisdom is jnana, or we could say prajna, basically almost the same as jnana. And accumulation is the term used from a non-dual perspective. We usually don't talk about accumulating anything. And accumulating wisdom seems kind of funny too. But we could say it's like learning the intricacies of prajna, paramita. There is a deepening understanding of wisdom. Thus, there's 84,000 wisdom teachings. It's an endless lifetime project, I think, to deepen our understanding of perfect wisdom, of emptiness and non-duality. That's what we're talking about when we say wisdom in the Mahayana. But then we also have the accumulation of merit, punya. And that's basically, we could say, also, we could say that a Buddha is, what is a Buddha actually? If we say, if we're defining a Buddha in the Mahayana, it's the full realization of, sometimes it's even said omniscience, but we could just say complete all-pervading wisdom. Omniscience is actually English for sarva jnana. So all knowing or complete wisdom, and maybe we combine, and with the skillful means, omniscience would be like understanding the farthest reaches of ultimate truth and conventional truth, and how to help each being individually through the Dharma, and. So the accumulation of wisdom is the cause for this complete all-knowing Buddha. And then the accumulation of merit is the condition for the other aspect of Buddha that's great compassion, maha karuna, all-pervading, unhindered compassion for all beings. So this merit and wisdom are the conditions for these two aspects of a Buddha, of perfect wisdom and perfect compassion. And we hear a lot about the wisdom teachings. And we also hear about the merit teachings are like, basically, you could break it into the five paramitas. And then wisdom is the sixth paramita, prajna paramita. The complete accumulation or fulfillment, maybe we could say, of merit and wisdom is all that's needed for Buddhahood. And then if that list seems too short, too simple, we'd say, let's break it down into the six paramitas. The first five are merit, and the six is wisdom. And that's all we need. And I've said before, and the more I reflect on this, the more I feel like the six paramitas is like really a complete teaching. It's the whole path, and it's, I think the Zen ancestors would agree, and the classic Mahayana scholastics would agree that everything's included in these six paramitas. So accumulation of merit, and what is this merit? So it's sometimes talked about as it's like merit is like making a connection to sentient beings. It's kind of maybe a new way to hear it. Making a connection to sentient beings is merit. Making the connection to sentient beings and cultivating those connections. And another way to look at it is it's making positive imprints in the mind. So it seems closely related to good karma, good intentional activity. that makes these positive imprints, that's shaping and shifting the mind in this positive direction towards more openness and compassion. Whereas wisdom is also making accumulation of wisdom, or like understanding. If we're talking about accumulation, maybe we would say the accumulation from actually learning in, you know, conventional teachings, wisdom teachings, because prajnaparamita can't be accumulated. But these practices of the first five paramitas, it's training our body and mind. It's opening us to, they're all basically related to other beings and connecting in that way. Can we wait a little bit more? If you remember? And so giving is a great practice that particularly this week, I feel like supports Sesshin, and Sesshin supports giving. This is true, I think, of all of these paramitas. Sesshin greatly supports giving. We're like, we've set up this container so we don't have to do too much. And then we have all these opportunities for like the tenzo, maybe comes to mind as like one of the main opportunities to just wholeheartedly just give their whole life energy to just feeding the Sangha and the Buddha, and then the meal servers can come and actually practice this giving, and together we can do this giving and receiving, and we can give offerings of incense, we can give our bows, we can give our chanting, all our kind of ritual practices, including zazen, could be seen as giving practice, and therefore accumulating merit. And people noticed that a long time ago and said, hey, it's like, you know, making offerings and chanting sutras is making these positive imprints. We're not only with each other, we're joining together our practice mind and voice and body, but we're recalling wisdom teachings at the same time. So therefore we accumulate merit through these ritual activities. It's the classical understanding. And then, to even further that, we accumulate the merit, but then let's like give it away to increase it even more. We don't want to like hold on to like, I'm accumulating more and more merit here. Cool, like, how much merit do you have? I think I'm a little bit higher on the merit counter. No, however much, like let's accumulate as much as we can, but then just give it all away. That's what's called dedication of merit. We offer this merit with highest gratitude to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who are helping to remind us to accumulate merit and then give it away again. So Sesshin supports our giving, and then our giving supports Sesshin. You know, harmonizing with each other and giving our attention and kindness to each other helps support us all to settle more. And that's Dana Paramita. And Sila Paramita, the ethical conduct, is also greatly supported by Sesshin, the Bodhisattva precepts. Just with the first one alone, we're sitting in here most of the day, so there's not much chance for killing. You know, we don't even, like, we don't have to even drive, except to just go home, so we probably don't even need to run over any ants, the body of the tiniest ant is Buddha nature's flowing through. And we're having a vegetarian week, so we don't even have to contribute at all to the killing of animals. And all the other precepts too. All the speech precepts, much easier when you have a week of silence. So supportive for the precepts, so much easier than usual to practice with these bodhisattva precepts. And the precepts support sesshin, right? The more we can keep the silence and keep the body, speech, and mind practices, the more we support each other. And then we have shanti, paramita, patience, maybe the heart paramita of sesshin. Patience is, you know, basically acceptance of suffering. That's one definition of it. Patient tolerance and acceptance when harm is coming to us from others, which is not too much in a sesshin. And patient acceptance with just suffering in general. It's not really harm from others, but just the fact that we have this mortal body of flesh and bones, and we're putting it into a Buddha container and trying to sit like Buddhas. How absurd. But with patience, paramita, oh, it so much supports sesshin, doesn't it? All the ways we want to act out and run away and smash the whole thing sometimes. No, we just keep sitting. And our patience then supports the sesshin, oh, so much. Virya paramita, great diligence. Also, part of the heart of sesshin, patience and diligence working together, tolerance of what's happening, and this great determination to continue in the face of great difficulty. Jhana paramita, meditative concentration, period after period. Letting go of conceptual thought creates a room filled with samadhi-charged energy. So, traditionally it's said all five of those are like accumulation of merit. We say, well, even dhyana, meditative Zen, Zazen practice, and technically speaking, because they're all kind of conventional practices. Maybe as Dhyana starts to slip over into Prajna Paramita, when we just are letting go of everything, that Zazen that's not, then the Zazen of non-grasping is now starting to manifest the wisdom of Prajnaparamita. So, as Bhajang says, this Buddha nature readily utilizes cause and effect. It's the free activity of merit and wisdom. Buddha nature is the free activity of the paramitas being practiced. So they're being practiced actually by Buddha nature. That's who practices them. We might think, I have to really work on this giving practice. I'm feeling kind of stingy. Well, we could just say, well, let's let Buddha nature work on it for us. So then Dogen says, such are Bhaijang's words. Five skandhas is this present indestructible body of ours. So referring to Buddha nature, is negotiating the five skandhas like a gate freely opening. What are five skandhas? Five skandhas, the ever-changing, arising and ceasing, completely impermanent aspects of body and mind, are the present indestructible body. Funny, huh? So this refers to a Zen story. A monk asked, "Jiaojiao, I've heard you say that when the world perishes, its nature will not." The nature of the world. Dharma nature, Buddha nature. "I've heard you say that when the world ends, its nature will not end, because its nature is permanent. What is that nature?" Jiaojiao said, "The four great elements in the five skandhas. Earth, wind, fire, water, constantly changing. Five skandhas, constantly changing." The monk said, "That's what perishes. What about its nature?" Jiaojiao said, "The four great elements in the five skandhas." A teaching of non-duality. The impermanent, ever-changing four elements and five skandhas are the indestructible present body of ours. Form itself is emptiness. Our present activity, moment to moment, a gate freely opening, does not suffer impediments from the five skandhas. The five skandhas that are this indestructible body of ours. Completely utilizing life, it cannot be held back by life. Completely utilizing death, it cannot be obstructed by death. Do not vainly cherish life. Do not foolishly dread death. They are where the Buddha nature is. Life and death. We've been hearing a lot about life. All of life is manifesting the Buddha nature, but Buddha nature in death. Clinging with attachment to life, shrinking in abhorrence from death, is, the straight letter says, un-Buddhist. We say unhelpful too. To realize that life and death are a combination of conditions manifesting themselves before your eyes is to be able to utilize a way that's totally unhindered. This is the Buddha of the highest vehicle. Where this Buddha is, there is the wondrous land of purity. So, clinging with attachment to life, shrinking in abhorrence from death is un-Buddhist, or is not in accord with Buddha's way. And this is reminiscent of Shobogenzo Shoji, birth and death, Dogen's short fascicle on birth and death, where he says, "Your present birth and death itself is the life of Buddha. If you attempt to reject it with aversion, you thereby lose the life of Buddha." So, this goes back to our earlier question, right? Well, if the rejection is itself Buddha, then do we really lose the life of Buddha if we're rejecting birth and death with aversion? On the one hand, no. And on the other hand, yes. Does the dog have Buddha nature? On the one hand, no. On the other hand, yes. if you if you attempt to reject your present birth and death with aversion, you thereby lose the life of Buddha, because your birth and death is the life of Buddha. If you abide in it, attaching to birth and death, you also lose the life of Buddha and are left with only its outward appearance. You attain the mind of Buddha only when there's no hating of birth and death and no desiring of nirvana, the freedom from birth and death. But do not try to measure it with your mind or explain it with words. When you let go of both your body and mind, forget them both and throw yourself into the house of Buddha, or throw your body and mind into the house of Buddha. And when functioning begins from the side of Buddha, drawing you in to accord with it, then with no need for any expenditure of either physical or mental effort, you are freed from birth and death and become Buddha. When functioning comes from the side of Buddha that draws you into accord with it. Next story. Huang Bo was sitting in Nan Chuan's tea room. You might recall this story from a few days ago. Nan Chuan said, practicing samadhi and prajna equally, you clearly see the Buddha nature. Quoting the Mahaparinirvana Sutra. And just for fun, to get the full sutra excerpt here, which is not brought up in the story. But the Mahaparinirvana says, Bodhisattvas of the 10 Bodhisattva stages, because they have great power from prajna, wisdom, but little from samadhi, cannot see Buddha nature clearly. Bodhisattvas are really into prajnaparamita. They're totally into like the Heart Sutra, and the Prajnaparamita Sutras are very long. and the, all those Mahayana sutras that the Bodhisattvas read are very long, so they there's a lot of wisdom in there, but because they're spending so much time studying prajna, they don't have any time for zazen. So they're developing a lot of prajna, but not so much samadhi, meditative concentration, so they can't really see the Buddha nature clearly, the Bodhisattvas. Shravakas and Pratika Buddhas have shorter sutras to read. It doesn't say that, but the Pali Canon sutras are much shorter than the Parinirvana and the Prajnaparamita sutras. And they're simpler too. And the wisdom is less subtle and extensive. So they have more time for zazen. It doesn't say this, but it just says, Shravakas and Pratika Buddhas, because they have great power from samadhi, but little from prajna, wisdom, they cannot see the Buddha nature clearly. Or actually, it literally says, they cannot see the Buddha nature, period. The Bodhisattvas can't see it clearly. But Buddhas, world-honored ones, because they possess samadhi and prajna in equal measure, they clearly see Buddha nature, clearly and unobstructedly, like a fruit in the palm of their hand. So, making some distinctions between Shravakas, Bodhisattvas, and Buddhas. But Nan Chuan is just talking about the Buddhas here when he quotes the sutra and says, practicing samadhi and prajna equally, you clearly see the Buddha nature. What's the essence of that teaching? Huang Bo, and I think Huang Bo is his student. What's the essence of that principle? Huang Bo said, The essence of that principle is attained when you don't depend on a single thing throughout the 24 hours. The essence of seeing Buddha nature clearly when practicing samadhi and prajna equally is when you don't depend on anything all day long. We talk about everything is dependently arising. There's nothing but interdependence. And as we chanted this morning in the Gendo Koan, birth and death abide in the phenomenal expression in the Dharma position of birth, which fully includes and is dependent on past and future and is independent of past and future also. So abiding in one's Dharma position on the one hand, we're independent of everything, where there isn't anything else in the complete present without considering the workings of interdependent arising. There's nothing but this one complete moment of experience, standing alone, independent, radiant, experientially speaking. Doctrinally speaking, we say, of course, it's dependent on infinite causes and conditions. But in one flashing moment, this Dharma position is includes, we could also say, because it includes everything, it's independent. There's nothing to depend on. Everything is right here. So he just says this: the essence of this sutra statement is attained when you're not depending on a single thing throughout 24 hours. Nan Chuan, his teacher, says, "Elder monk, isn't that the attainment you yourself have achieved?" Huangbo said, "No, not at all." Nan Chuan said, "Forget for now about the cost of the food and drink you've had here. Who's going to pay for those straw sandals of yours?" With that, Huangbo abandoned the conversation. Strange story. Getting stranger and stranger. Not so far out to just say the essence is attained when you're not depending on a single thing throughout 24 hours. But then Nan Chuan says, well, Huangbo, isn't that the attainment you yourself have achieved? So we don't know exactly what he's saying here. Is he saying, is he kind of poking at like, you know, that sounded pretty confident and this independence you're talking about, is that your personal attainment? And we could hear something like this. And Huangbo says, "No, not at all." Which, as Dogen will later comment, says, this is a Chinese expression, much like our English expression, "No, not at all," or "Don't mention it." Doi tashimashite. How do you translate that? Yeah.
It's nothing.
It's not. So like that. It's like that. You know, when somebody says, "Domo arigato gozaimashita," thank you very much, you say, "Doitashimashite." I mean, don't. It means it's nothing. It's just a humble expression. So in English we say, oh no, it's nothing. Beautiful, humble saying. So it's like that. Is that your attainment? No, not at all. In other words, yes. But humbly speaking, no, not at all. Nan Chuan said, forget for now about the cost of food and drink you've had here in the monastery. With this answer, don't worry about trying to pay back all the meals you've had here on the monastery's behalf. But who's going to pay for those straw sandals of yours? And so straw sandals is in Zen the symbol for going on pilgrimage to practice. You put on your straw sandals to visit Zen teachers and learn, accumulate wisdom. When you've been practicing here with me and eating this temple's food and drink, I'll forgive you of that. But all those years of study that you've done walking around with your straw sandals, who's going to pay for that? For all those straw sandals that you wore out on your pilgrimage? How will your debt of gratitude be repaid with that answer? Or if that's all you can say, I'll forgive you having to repay the food and drink, because the food and drink of the temple here is only for your accumulation of merit and wisdom. So if that's all you can say, it's okay. But all those people that supported you to go on pilgrimage and wear out those straw sandals, who's gonna pay them back? One way to hear this. Huangmo abandoned the conversation. Okay, enough of this. I better not say anything more. Dogen says, the essential meaning of practicing samadhi and prajna equally is not, since the practice of samadhi does not impinge on the practice of prajna, you clearly see Buddha nature when both are practiced equally. It does not mean that that since samadhi doesn't hinder prajna, you practice them equally. Rather, it is clearly seeing the Buddha nature is a practice in which samadhi and prajna are in equal balance. So he changes it from the practice, when practicing samadhi and prajna, you clearly see the Buddha nature. Dogen turns it to seeing the Buddha nature is the practice in which samadhi and prajna are in equal balance. So he's changing it from the dualistic sense that, if you practice samadhi and prajna equally and you, for a long time, you'll eventually have this result of seeing the Buddha nature. But we know that for Dogen, practice and realization are not two. So seeing Buddha nature cannot be a result of a practice, but it can be a practice. Seeing Buddha nature can be a practice. Maybe we could say can be a practice, as opposed to a result. Seeing Buddha nature right now, in this moment, is the practice in which samadhi and prajna are equally balanced. Nan Chuan is articulating what is the meaning of that. is a question was, as you might recall, he quotes the sutra and then he says, what is the essence of that teaching? So Nan Chuan is articulating what is the meaning of that, as Dogen often uses these terms, like what and that, to mean complete suchness, things as they are. So it's not a question, it's a statement, right? What is the meaning of that? The meaning of that is what? He is in effect saying that clearly seeing Buddha nature is the act of who? To say, if you practice Buddha and nature equally, you will clearly see the Buddha nature. What is the meaning of that is also an authentic utterance of truth. So, if you practice Buddha and nature equally, you will clearly see Buddha nature. What's the meaning of that? That whole statement is also an authentic utterance of truth. Huangbo said, when you're not depending on a single thing throughout the 24 hours, essentially this means even though the 24 hours exist within the 24 hours of each day, they are non-depending. The 24 hours are non-depending. Time is itself being, and being, time, abiding in its dharma position, is independent of past and future. So Dogen says, because not depending on a single thing is within the 24 hours, it is Buddha nature clearly seeing. As for the 24 hours, when it's not, as for the 24 hours, when is not the time of their arrival? Always now. In what land does their arrival not occur? Are the 24 hours referred to here 24 hours in the human world? Are they 24 hours somewhere else? Or is this the temporary arrival of 24 hours in a land of white silver, which is apparently the pure land of Samantabhadra Bodhisattva? Bodhisattva of great activity. Whatever the case, whether it's our own world or another world, it's non-depending. In fact, this lies within the 24 hours and can only be non-depending. So Dogen is actually praising this non-depending, but not so much like you should do the practice of not relying or depending on a single thing. It's more that throughout the 24 hours, it's more that the 24 hours themselves are independently abiding in the Dharma position of right now. Elder monk, isn't that the attainment you yourself have achieved? Quoting the story. That's the same as saying, isn't that the Buddha nature clearly seeing? Even though Nan Chuan makes this utterance about it being Huangbo's attainment, Huangbo must not turn his head as if it referred to him. So, isn't that the attainment you yourself have achieved? He shouldn't turn his head and be like, no, not at all. Because you yourself is not the one you think you are. Although it may apply very well to Huangbo, it does not refer to Huangbo. Huangbo, you yourself, we're talking about. Huangbo certainly is not necessarily only himself, because a master's way of attainment is utterly unrestricted and all-pervading. Huangbo said, no, not at all. Dogen says, In Song China, when a person is asked about some talent or ability he may possess, even if he wishes to acknowledge the ability, he answers, "No, not at all." Hence the words, "No, not at all," do not literally mean "no, not at all." They are not to be taken at face value. As for the mode of understanding of a Zen teacher, even though he's a teacher or even though he's a Huangbo, when he speaks, he has no choice but to say, "No, not at all." Now, we don't know if he's playing into also here, "No, not at all," which is appearing throughout this essay as "mu." But just that Zen teachers have no choice but to say "no, not at all," especially in Song China. That's the custom. When a water buffalo appears, it can only say "oing, oing." Another translation says "mm, mm." This kind of utterance is authentic for a water buffalo. Water buffalo say "oing, oing," and Zen teachers say "no, not at all." Try to utter the essential meaning of his utterance. Make an utterance on his utterance, if you'd like to. You may. Nanchuan said, "Forget for now about the cost of the food and drink you've had here. Who's going to pay for those straw sandals of yours?" Dogen says, "You should commit yourself for many lifetimes to probing the meaning of this utterance. You should concentrate your mind and study deliberately why it is he does not concern himself with the cost of the food and drink." Forget for now about the cost of the food and drink. But we have to very diligently study, why does he not concern himself with the cost of the food and drink? The reason he's so concerned about the straw sandals is because he assumes that in the years of pilgrimage, many pairs of them must have been worn out. Here one must say, if I couldn't pay for the sandals, I wouldn't put them on to begin with. So this is a kind of, I think, straightforward thing Dogen's maybe saying here, is just sort of an admonition about if we're going to practice with the great support of many beings, which is how we practice, right? Let's remember our debt of gratitude always, and just continuously remember how can we ever pay back the debt of gratitude to all beings who are helping us to practice and get the spirit here. And if we just say, "Don't worry about them, I'm just gonna realize the way here and then check out of this messy place. You guys work it out yourselves." If we think that way, we shouldn't put on the straw sandals to begin with. I think that's how I hear what he's saying. Again, he says, here one must say, if I couldn't pay for the sandals, I wouldn't put them on to begin with, unquote. So, or maybe I shouldn't put them on to begin with if I can't pay back the debt of gratitude for the support of my practice. Again, one must say, "Oh, two or three pairs." It has to be utterances like those. It has to have that kind of essential significance. With that, Huangbo abandoned the conversation. Dogen says, this means that he cut the conversation off, but it was not because he did not accept Nanchuan's response. We might say that Nanchuan said this kind of critical thing, so Huangbo is just like desisted, or kind of like, okay, enough of this conversation. But Dogen says it's not because he did not accept Narang Chuan's response. With patchwork disciples of true colors, that could never occur. You have to realize that the words in their silence are the same as the razor's edge on a laugh. Remember we talked about that. Is there a blade in his laughter? Does the laugh have Manjushri's sword that can cut through? So you have to realize that the words in the silence, when Huangbo abandoned the conversation, are the same as a razor's edge in a laugh. His silence is complete expression. It's the Buddha nature clearly seeing rice gruel and rice in inexhaustible abundance. Or it's the Buddha nature clearly seen as rice porridge and rice in inexhaustible abundance, which is a kind of a Zen saying, is like when your rice gruel and rice are sufficient and abundant, that's kind of like you're satisfied with your daily meals, is like you're at ease with what's happening. Things are fine. It's okay. My butt hurts, but it's okay. Whatever meals arrive, they're fine. If they run out, it's okay. If we eat too much and we feel too full, it's okay. Just enough, always. That's what orioki means. Orioki is just the right amount container. Literally, orioki. If you'd like to, before we leave this story for the day, ask any succinct and pointed questions at any particular word or syllable. Yes.
It seems to me what's being said is that there aren't many Buddhas, there's one Buddha, and that there are many people or many beings with Buddha nature and tendency towards Buddha, and that the activity of Busho could be said to be Sambhogaya, emerging in difference in unity, which might also be samadhi and prajna.
And is there a question in that?
Is that
what? The merging of difference and unity, the harmony of interdependence and independence, the merging of Buddha and nature, the harmony of samadhi and prajna practiced equally, the merging of life and death and aversion to them are completely expressing Buddha nature, and merged with the aversion to life and death blocks us off from the life of Buddha. Yes.
Not depending on anything in 24 hours, we have just really simple instruction of non-attachment. I mean, it's just easier to get through the day if you don't have a fixed idea. I need it to do this.
Yeah, that's a good point. That we could say, I think if we put it like, not depending on any particular thing, but depending on whatever is arising, like that. Not depending on any particular thing the way that we feel like we have to have it. Yeah, is in that way we settle into the presence of samadhi and the wisdom of non-preference equally, and therefore Buddha nature is practiced as clearly seeing a fruit in our hand.
Phenomena in the relative truth, and that idea that you described, the non-dependence, the abiding in this moment that includes everything. It's kind of that.
Yeah.
The absolute world.
Yeah, I think that's another way to talk about two truths, of conventional truth of interdependent network of interdependent origination, and independence because there's no thing to depend on, and there's no arising to co-arise interdependently. And so I think all three of those questions were kind of pointing at that, you know, merging of difference and unity is also, you could say, merging of the two truths. You know, we say merging. At some point, the San Francisco Zen Center changed the translation to harmony. And I think there was some discussion about that. The possibly problematic nuances of the word merging, because it's not exactly like your difference and unity are like mushed together somehow. I don't know. All these English words have different flavors, but or the two truths are like merged, because then it almost implies that they're like they become indistinguishable, or they become like maybe indistinguishable, and like some kind of mix of them both. Whereas it's more like the two truths remain the two truths at the same time, almost like they don't obstruct each other. So harmony is pretty good in that way, I think. But even that might be a little off. It's hard to find a word for the relationship between difference and unity, for the relationship between independence and interdependence.
The reason I use merging in this case, and will continue to, is because merging is something that's actively done. Because of harmonizing difference and unity, as long as it's got some activity in it. So I think the Sangha guide impels us to action, not to mere observation. Don't waste time.
Well, if we're talking about the two truths, it's hard to say that we practice merging the two truths. But yet, in you could say we can practice the union of the two truths. We can, or our practice is actually happening in the non-duality of the two truths. But if it's like we have to kind of take the conventional truth over here and the ultimate truth over here and then do the activity of like putting them together, it's also maybe a little tricky. But you could say our activity, in our activity, they are working together.
That's isn't that prajna and samadhi?
Yeah, we could say like that. When they're practiced equally, like the sutra says, when they're practiced equally, doesn't mean like you're exactly merging the samadhi and prajna. But you could also say, if you look closely, like the sixth ancestor, one of his great things is saying, don't ever say that samadhi and prajna are two different things. So, one is the essence and one is the function, but it's one practice. So it is an active practice that we do, an active practice of wholehearted engagement in the present activity reveals the union of the two truths.
Quick question. I just would like to request a little more clarification between what you were saying and what the Ina said a moment ago. I felt like I was sort of following what you were saying, and then there was a triangulation of the three conversations. And so when you were talking about the conventional truth of individuality as coming together of numerous causes. I didn't understand the nuances that you were making between conventional and ultimate reality and the shifting of the position of each.
Basically we could say dependent co-arising of each unique thing and person and phenomena in the world is what we call the conventional truth. And the conventional truth is the arising and ceasing of everything moment to moment in its uniqueness, but still dependent on conditions. If we say that, like, we could bring in a third thing here too, of like, to think that like this is the way actually I often see it is it's just like it's not a dependent arising stick. It's just like it's always been here, and it's kind of permanent in my mind. It'll always exist. It's the way like before examining, it seems that way. And you could say that's not the independence that we're going to talk about later. That's like just, that's not the ultimate truth. That's just ultimate delusion. So you could say, one way we could say is like the way we usually see is not even the conventional truth. The way we usually see it's just not truth. It's falsity that this is a really like inherently existing stick. And then we look more closely and we see, oh no, it's actually dependent on our mind and various other conditions. And it doesn't exist in the independent way we see it, but it's, you know, moment to moment it appears due to conditions. So that appearance, dependently arisen appearance, is a conventional truth. And then the ultimate truth is that it doesn't even arise and cease. Because the arising and ceasing is just like, it's just a mere appearance according to conditions. So that's the level of emptiness where there actually is no stick. There's a dependently co-arisen stick is the conventional truth. There's no stick at all is like the Heart Sutra, the ultimate truth of emptiness, ultimate truth. And then and we could say that's in this kind of Zen talk that's an independent, because it's no stick, it's independent of all conditions. in this one moment of the ultimate truth, abiding in its Dharma position, it doesn't arise and cease, depending on conditions. In that way, that independence is like the ultimate truth. You know, like Nagarjuna wouldn't usually say it that way. He's the kind of master of the two truths. He wouldn't use the word independence probably, but that seems like what Dogen's talking about with this thing about the Dharma, in the Dharma position, something is dependent, and it's also for that one moment, free of all conceptual ideas, it's independent of anything. And in a way, it's not a thing at that time. Maybe that's a good point, that when it's independent, it's not a thing. So like two kind, there's the deluded independence, the way we usually see things, and then there's this kind of Dogen's independence that's like ultimate truth. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.